Welcome to Unspeakable, the podcast of the Cthulhu gaming magazine, The Unspeakable Oath. This is episode 20, hosted by Ross Payton of Slang Design and Roleplaying Public Radio, Scott Glanzy of Pagan Publishing, and Shane Ivey of Arc Dream Publishing. Our guest today is Oscar Rios, publisher of Golden Goblin Press and author of literally 8,000 scenarios for Call of Cthulhu.
He is one productive bastard.
It's not quite that many.
It's enough that we feel threatened by you. We feel deeply threatened.
Shane, would you like to talk about our sponsors for this episode?
So what you should do is everybody fire up the last episode and listen to the sponsors part, and it's going to be exact. So yeah, Atlas Games, of course, with Where the Deep Ones Are and Unknown Armies, and atlasgames.com/Cthulhu4Kids. Actually, Unknown Armies is not there; that's somewhere else. But you get the idea. And Innsmouth Free Press also supported the last issue of The Oath with Sword and Mythos, edited by Silvia Moreno Garcia at InsmouthFreePress.com. And Scott, am I remembering right? She had some announcement recently on Facebook or something.
Who was that?
Sylvia.
There's a number of things been going on with her, and the one thing that stuck out was actually she had recently made another announcement about Fractured, which was a collection of post-apocalyptic Canadian science fiction. Mm-hmm. But that's the last thing that rolled past my eyeballs. I can't think of anything else off the top of my head.
Well, anyway, she's good people, and Sword and Mythos is very, very fun, so check that out. And Arkham Gazette, of course, Brett Kramer's magazine about Lovecraft Country for Call of Cthulhu, and it sort of drills down. It stays focused on the kind of 20s and 30s setting at sentinelhillpress.wordpress.com. Golden Goblin Press with Island of Ignorance and Tales from the Crescent City and Dehor Cosmico and goldengoblinpress.com. And we may hear something about that later on. And then, of course, the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival with the new one in Portland coming up.
Yay!
And then another one in San Pedro, California at the beginning of May. So if you are all over flying to Oregon and California, you could go to two film festivals in the space of, like, 2 weeks at hplfilmfestival.com. And anything else we want to say about the sponsors? I kind of rattled through them at lightning speed.
You did, but the last time we meandered and lovingly stroked them for at least half the episode, and I worry that we may have been leaving our guest Brett hanging for way too long on that one.
Well, I just looked up the Innsmouth Free Press website, and they are having a sale on one of their books, the Necronomicon. It is a collection of 13 stories by Nick Mamatas, and it's on sale right now. Print edition's only $10. So,
awesome. Okay.
Very nice.
So, news type things. I guess I'll go first as quick as I can. The Oath 25 still in the works. We did. Between the last recording and this one, I've been focusing on all kinds of other things, but they're now kind of under control, so I'm going to move back onto the Oath in the next week or so, and then we'll hopefully have the scenarios that we're picking and choosing from going into playtesting on that. Delta Green Extraordinary Renditions, the fiction collection, all of its stories, or almost all of them, are in the hands of the Delta Green team now, Scott and Dennis and John, for their notes and
just got that this week
and approvals and so forth. And there's a couple that are still outstanding that we'll be bringing in soon if all goes well. One of them's by me, so I'll have to crack the whip on me to make sure that I've done.
Excellent. Some self-flagellation. That's what we're hoping for.
That's pretty much all that works. The Delta Green game, Ray Wininger is reviewing the main manuscript, and then we have new chunks of that on sort of all the details, the setting stuff that's kind of player facing setting stuff about.
If the man who brought us Ray Winninger's Underground can't make Delta Green more bleak and hopeless, then no one can.
There's
a review I found online recently of Underground that is broken up into various chapters. It's a huge review. Yeah. And one of them is one of the chapters on the setting is what kind of God would let a world like this exist? And the sad news is we would, because, you know, again, the damn underground is turning out to be the network of role playing games.
Yeah, it actually has more in common with the world now than it did 20 years ago. Yeah,
it's not a good picture, kids. It's not a good mirror to hold up and look into. It really isn't.
Yep. So, the Delta Green, you know, all that material is kind of coming together. We've got other writers and experts, subject matter experts, who are sort of ready to sink their teeth into some of the setting things as soon as Scott and I finalize a couple of issues, key issues, foundational things before they get started. And then Dennis's Patreon account, or Patreon, if you want to spell it correctly, he posted an excerpt of Viscid, which is this big sort of mini campaign or, you know, mega scenario for Delta Green that he's working on, that we played a few, like three sessions of it at Gen Con night by night last year. And it was super fun. And we completely fucked it up and did everything wrong. It was hilarious. That was like those three nights I could spend a couple of hours just telling you the story of what our characters did, and it was because it was that amusing and horrifying and awful. But you can see the ugly details in his excerpts that he's posted on his for Patreon backers. What else? We've got No Soul Left Behind. It's in layout now, still in layout. And Puppet Land is still in illustration and writing, the new material that's being developed for John Tynes's game that we're doing in a sort of expanded color storybook, hardback, awesome edition. On Facebook and other places, Samuel Araya, who's doing the color illustrations for that, has been posting photos of his sculptures that he's doing for models for a lot of his paintings. So you can see he's got sort of a along the way progress of his sculpt of Mr. Punch, the horrible, you know, vicious tyrant of Puppet Land that he's been doing. That's been really kind of cool and grody.
he's more the Kim Il Sung, isn't he, of Puppet Land than say a Saddam Hussein or a
no? He's a pretty Stalin-esque figure. Or even Lin. I mean, he overthrows the old regime.
If Kim Il Sung was doing all of his own dirty work, then we've also got Ninth Legion that Arc Dream is working on, that is a setting book that's based on Greg Stolze's sword and sorcery game Reign, but this is like its own new setting that's kind of the Roman legion in the Roman Empire that gets lost in somewhere in Britain and gets stuck in this sort of Celtic fairy otherworld and then stays there forever. So it's like 100 years later and you're playing the descendants in this kind of imperial Roman colony that's trying to survive in this kind of magical otherworld that keeps changing and going crazy on them. So it's very fun and has a lot of really weird things in it. So we just started playtesting on that. We'll take a Kickstarter in a few weeks, as soon as we have the last one roll engine thing, No Soul Behind out in people's hands, so we don't have people screaming at us.
Which would be No Soul Left Behind. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then other things, you know, we've talked about before, WrestleNomicon, this Great Old Ones fighting game that Dennis and I are working on. And you mentioned Underground. We've been talking to
Shouldn't that be Lucha Nomicon? I mean, you know, I couldn't help but notice that the it is not a mask. It wears no mask.
Right.
So that seems to fit in very nicely with your whole theme right there.
The luchador in yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
El luchador amarillo.
Well, I wear
no title belt.
Yeah, each of the great old ones has his own shtick, you know. So
okay, fair enough.
They don't all wear masks. And so we've been talking about talking to Ray about redoing a new edition of Underground that's actually mostly already written, but we've been kind of distracted by other things, so that's kind of percolating, and we'll see if we can come together on that sometime soon. Anyway, lots of stuff going on as always, and I'll skip all the other things and let other people talk, and then we can hear from Oscar for a change.
Okay. Hooray! Who's the next on?
Who's next? Who wants to go next? Scott or Ross?
Ross.
I'll go next. So RPVR still has a Patreon up, and still running games. So maybe put a link up for that. But the big news is that we have a contest for the best for fan creations for RPPR and Arc Dream games. So Arc Dream was so kind to donate some books to us. And so we will have a contest that ends on May 15th. And the idea is you listen through our actual plays of Arc Dream games, like the Heroes of New Arcadia, which is Wild Talents, our Dirty World games, No Soul Left Behind, Monsters and Other Childish Things, so on and so forth, and to create something to commemorate those games. It could be still art, a video, a written story, audio, like a radio play or a song, or something else entirely. And we also have a special category for PC Death. This category is unique in that any actual play episode can be used, and there's no restriction on form. Simply celebrate the many deaths of RPPR player characters in whatever way you see fit. Winners will get a specialized grab bag of RPPR swag and a copy of Base Raiders. You have until May 15th to enter it in. And we've already got some people talking about how they're going to commemorate the many deaths of player characters, or someone was writing a story based on The Wages of Sin, which is a Dirty World game. And so we're looking forward to a lot of great entries.
Ross, do you off the top of your head, your favorite death from one of your games?
I would, but I'm not, you know, going to stick to that. There's some people talking about doing, you know, one of our players, Aaron, has a tendency.
He should get his own category all his own. I mean, are you sure it's really fair to have Aaron's deaths there sort of competing with the deaths of amateur? What would we call him? A Thantakazi. I mean, he just he has a particular gift, really.
There is someone has already made a Aaron's character deaths Cthulhu edition.
All right.
Which I will share as a Google Doc of the many times that he has been killed, from shark punching to ripped apart by a gug to gunned down as a shotgun. Or being killed twice in the same scenario, you know, taking over one in the exact same way.
Was he responsible for that Well of Sacrifice doubleheader?
Yes.
Oh, it was him. Wow. Yep.
I'll go through the cave. All right, you're killed by giant bats. All right, well, here, you can have another character since there's a spare. Okay, well, I'll go into the cave again. I'll roll better this time.
Yeah, it was literally, I got killed doing that thing. Oh, good, I have a new character. I better do that thing again. And yeah. Unsurprisingly, now here's the question. Was he surprised he died twice?
A little bit. I think he thought he was...
Yeah. Wasn't there a scene like that in Spaceballs?
Hope Springs Eternal, I will say, for...
The thing that makes, you know, these awesome deaths awesome is when the player is not setting out to have an awesome death. and it still happens. That's the sweet spot for me.
Yeah. Because
you know, it's easy to have a character go die in Blaze of Glory if you set out for that. But when you're trying to play in character and you still explode all over the place, that's the good
stuff. Yeah, yeah, well, that one really gets me because it sounds like he actually had the gall to be shocked that doing the same exact thing resulted in the same. Really?
It's like, I saw what I did wrong last time, but let me try again. You know,
No, I don't think you did. Now that I come to think of it. All right. We are way picking on Aaron too much here. All right, let's move on. And I mean, Aaron, we love you.
Yeah. But we do. And there's many other notable deaths among player characters.
It's not so, like you haven't fallen off a Zeppelin now and again.
Exactly. I have. So that's a thing. So there's many other things. So that's the big thing we're doing right now is the contest. So if you want to commemorate it, there's even things from the I'll even allow stuff from the Unspeakable Oath actual plays, like the infamous dog punching incident. from one of Call of Cthulhu APs that was posted here.
And all of that's at slangdesign.com, right?
Slangdesign, well, I'll post a link to the RPPR forums in the show notes. And the RPPR actual play is actualplay.roleplayingpublicradio.com. But yeah, anyway.
Okay, Scott, what's up with you these days?
Well, first of all, I will just say that on a completely non-professional, what am I up to sort of thing, the second to the last, or actually the last original Paganista has left the original Pagan house.
Mm-hmm. You were here for that last time, weren't you?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Crow has left the house, and Mr. John Harry Crow has left Pagan house. To become a property owner down in Federal Way, Washington, and has taken an enormous number of animals with him and an enormous amount of stuff, and has left behind snowdrifts made out of pet dander and human skin cells in his wake. So this week has been about, actually last 2 weeks has been about helping him move. Mm-hmm. And then sort of cleaning, I guess, you know, at this point we're sort of cleaning the wound now that we've removed the festering piece of shrapnel. You know, there has been an enormous amount of destruction apparently from that happens when you move a person. So that's where a lot of my week has ended up. I have finished off my Swords v. Cthulhu project for the nice folks at Pelgrane. And dropped that off with my editor. The short story, is entitled Trespassers, and is what happens when you take a bunch of Cossacks and Gurkhas and Kashmiri sepoys and throw in a bunch of Chochos and shake well. And it has been a brutal project because I've been working with a word length, a word count, and I have failed to achieve my word count insofar as I have failed to get it short enough. It is still over the word count, but I am hoping that they will still find enough in there that they either will grant me dispensation or find something in the story that is worth removing. I've definitely spent a lot of time following the old advice of killing your darlings, which is the hardest thing you can do as a writer. Go, oh, I like that part. Get rid of it. It is in, and hopefully we'll be hearing back from them soon about, you know, what its status is. But that's done. That'll be for their Swords v. Cthulhu project. Horrors of War is crawling forward. We just got another artist who's going to be able to join us, David Lee Ingersoll, who's one of my favorite artists. He's a local up here in Seattle. He had some personal crisis that had come up that was going to take him out of the artist's pool for Horrors of War, but he has dodged those particular bullets and is going to be returning to do some work on starting with the scenario that you guys, that you, Shane, played in the, at Gen Con, the night mission. So he will be illustrating that.
Planes, yeah. Oh, fun.
Yes.
Nice.
Although, admittedly...
And that one with us too, wasn't that you and Caleb and Greg Stoltze and me?
I'm trying to remember who the third person.
Yeah.
There was. I want to say there was
Keith. Yeah,
Caleb.
Yeah,
I think.
Keith,
was there.
Oh, was it just Caleb? Yeah, yeah. Keith.
Or was it Keith Potter? And there's one other guy.
Yeah,
I don't remember who the other guy was, but it was Keith.
Remember, but yeah.
Yeah, we because we ended up with three airplanes.
Yeah,
with two crewmen apiece because we had so many players and. Regardless, he'll be returning and getting to work on that.
Yeah.
I'm still hoping I can lay a trail of breadcrumbs that'll bring Blair Reynolds to the project, but so far I have not been able to coax him into participating just yet, but I will keep my fingers crossed and keep sticking the pins in the doll. let's see what else. So, and the other thing is, now that I've done with some editing of some other projects, and of course I'm going to have to get on top of the editing you just handed to me for Extraordinary Renditions, is to get back to Delta Green writing. And hopefully I will have section done for Majestic, or I shouldn't say Majestic, but the Special Access Program. He says, hinting broadly, the special access program NPCs will be done by, hopefully by the middle of this month, is what I'm hoping for. And that's it. It's just you know, whittling away at Horrors of War, whittling away at Delta Green, and frankly, not taking on another project until both of those are done. I jumped at the Swords v. Cthulhu thing because of some advice that Tynes once said about never turn down anything. If people come to you and say, "Hey, how'd you like to do this?" You say yes, because you just have to pad that resume. I just can't take on anything else until Delta Green and Horrors are done. I was very pleased though to be able to take out some of John Crow's scenarios for Horrors of War and play test them at the recent GameStorm convention down in Vancouver, Washington. They ended up playing very well. They played very well, and they played in a way that I don't think the Keeper anticipated. The way the scenarios were written, there were certain aspects of the story that were very weighted, for the players, and my players were not interested in fighting off hordes of melee pirates. They were much more interested in what's in the big tank in the hold of the ship. And there was no reason to sex up the middle of the scenario by having some melee pirates turn up. They were completely smitten with the thing in the tank, and the scenario ran vastly differently and very successfully. The thing I thought was the showpiece is now actually should be moved into becoming an option, depending on how much fun your players are having. It was a very cool experience.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. So let's move on and. Let's hear from Oscar, because he's been quiet.
Hi, guys.
He's the one we're here to talk to, and we're just talking and talking and talking without him. Hi, Oscar.
Hello.
So, Oscar Rios. Tell us about Oscar Rios.
You can do better than that.
I started, actually, if you're going to tell us about Oscar Rios, I started as a... Conrat fanboy for Chaosium. about 15 years ago, running and writing convention rounds for their, you know, their, they used to have an international team of people who'd go to cons and promote Call of Cthulhu. So I was part of that group for a while. And, you know, they were like, hey, we need extra convention rounds and we'll give you a $50 gift certificate if you write something. And I'm like, well, I like stuff. So I started writing.
And you had yet to appreciate just how much work goes into writing.
It was tough. And, you know, it was one of those I'd been running games for a long time and all of my friends said, hey, these are really good. What book does this come out of? And I'm like, I kind of came up with it on my own. I'm like, dude, yeah, you should totally be writing. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. So then finally I'm like, oh, $50, maybe I will write something. And I started writing scenarios and, you know, it became very addictive, very addicting very quickly. You know, to write something and run it and see people appreciate it.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure you don't. And I've seen you run games. I know that you and I are, you know, chasing the same dragon there, pal.
Yeah.
Funny story. I ran a game across the room from you at Necronomicon 2 years ago. And my wife is kind of like a complete gamer snob. She will not game at conventions. You know, she'll only game with people she knows. And she's looking around and she goes, you know, that guy over there, he runs a really good game. I wouldn't mind playing his game. And I just glance up to see who she's talking about, and it was you. And I'm like, well, yeah, you've got good taste. If I wasn't running a game, I'd be playing in that one.
Yeah.
And she, again, had no idea who anyone really was, but I knew.
Let me assure you, at the next Necronomicon, I am not running 24 hours of gaming in a single convention. That was stupid.
Yeah, I saw you there a lot.
I missed all the cool stuff.
I was going to say, that show, there's like all kinds of other things that are worth doing besides just sitting at the table and, you know.
Well, they let me in for free, so I had this crazy idea I needed to, you know, bring something, you know, pay my way with some labor. And so, like, what, 4 panels and 4 6-hour gaming sessions later, I'm like, there was a convention?
Right.
I don't know. So, yeah.
Well, it is fun. I mean, you say that, but I bet if you didn't run games at a con, you'd feel unfulfilled. Because I've seen you run games. Like us, that's what we do. That's our
bar. Is there a bar at the convention? Because I think I could feel fulfilled if there was a bar.
All right. I think you're lying to one of us.
Only to my AA counselor.
But no, from there, I had my first monograph, and I wrote monographs for a while.
Which ones did you start off with?
My very first one was Ripples from Carcosa. And that one was a hoot. And that's kind of where I like to think I became, actually, if I can call myself a writer, that's where I became a writer. Because when I had the manuscript for that kind of done, I kind of fanboy stalked Richard Watts, who wrote some of the great scenario.
Lots and lots of stuff, yeah.
Lots and lots of stuff. And one of my favorite scenarios of all time, Tatterdemalion, a great, great King and Yellow scenario. And I said, hey, you know, I'm like, you know, Joe Nobody from the internet, and I wrote my own scenario, and, you know, you know, and he was like, yeah, kid, sure, you know, let me take a look at it. I'll tell you what I think. And I'm like, oh, my God, Richard Watts wants to see my stuff. So I sent him the outline, you know, the manuscript for Ripples from Carcosa. And he wrote me back a 4-page email. And it was 4 paragraphs on everything he liked and 3.5 pages of everything that was wrong and how to fix it.
Yeah.
And that was it was like the Rosetta Stone for writing scenarios. And I was like, and I, you know, I, a lot of people would have been like, oh, this is, you know, criticism and I know better. But me, I was smart enough at that point to be like, you know, I respected him so greatly. I really picked apart that email. And from then on, it's like whatever success I've had, I probably owe to that one act of kindness, you know, that one bit of guidance from one of the masters. And from that, you know, it kind of took off. I fell in with Miskatonic River Press with Keith Herber and Tom Lynch when they first got started up. You know, I mean, I was still writing for Chaosium, but it was like spot work. It was when they had something, when they had a competition or when they had a collection come out, you know. So they weren't really churning stuff out. And as you guys joke, I write a lot. It was really just a way to look for a home for my stuff. I fell in with MRP and was with them until they kind of shuttered. And, you know, wrote a lot. And I was lucky enough that I was able to start editing other people's work and getting involved with production, with keeping track of artists and layout and cartographers and starting to see more of just, instead of just how to write a scenario is how to take other people's scenarios and make them better, how to take all of these scenarios and put them into a book, you know, how to actually put a book together. You know, so it was kind of a piecemeal crash course in how to do this. And then Tom just kind of ran out of steam with MRP. And he was like, I can't do this. I'm too busy. I'm going back to, you know, grad school. I'm going to get my degree. And, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. And I was just like, well, I'm just kind of starting to figure out how to do this. And him and I had talked about forming a new company after Keith passed away unexpectedly.
Yeah.
It looked like we weren't going to be able to take over Miskatonic River Press for a while. Because there were some questions about, you know, who the company belonged to after his death and how they wanted to proceed. So we had the bright idea together to say, you know, the fictional company Golden Goblin Press is supposed to be owned by two brothers in New York. And, you know, we're in New York, and if we have to form a new company, that's what we should name it. And it was just kind of a funny idea. And then it Miskatonic River Press went on. You know, we sorted it out and we had a run for a few years after that. But when Tom said, "Oh, I'm kind of done," I was like, "Well, I'm going to proceed as Golden Goblin Press," and got my license and you know, put my first Kickstarter together, and we've been doing not too bad ever since.
Yeah. Awesome. So give us a rundown of what Golden Goblin has already put out there into the world, and then let's look at where you are now.
Cool. When we started doing Golden Goblin, we really we like to call our style updated old school. I'm a huge fan of the Golden Age scenarios from the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, I just love the stories, love the writing. Love the way that they're put together, but since that time, writing for RPGs has changed a lot. People have really they've wanted a lot more options. They've wanted a lot more sandbox aspects, and they really didn't want, you know, railroady kind of scenarios. And a lot of those early great Cthulhu scenarios are terribly railroady. You know, because you had all the influences of the indie games and a lot of new, you know, more sophisticated role players coming on to the scene. So scenarios now have to be written much differently than they had to be. But we wanted to take that vibe, you know, that kind of style and that feel, and update them in a way that they would work for more modern gamers, you know, basically open them up, make them more sandbox style, give a lot more options, Instead of a clue trail, you know, a web of clues
right.
to get through the entire investigation several different ways. We try to avoid choke points for our scenarios. And one other thing that we really set out to do is that if we're going to – we all discussed it and decided that if we were going to do this, we wanted to find new ground. We wanted to tell classic stories from a new angle. And we wanted to tell stories that had never been told before. We wanted that web of resolution. We tried to avoid single choke points. You know, if you don't find this clue, you're screwed. You know, we wanted to find new ground. If there's a monster in a book that no one has ever written a scenario about, it's on our to-do list to find someone to write a scenario about that monster. Mm-hmm. If there's a place that nobody has written a scenario in, we want to write a scenario in that place. So that's kind of where we're coming from. So our first book was Island of Ignorance, the Third Cthulhu Companion. And we did Island of Ignorance, the Third Cthulhu Companion, to just kind of be that shout out to the first and the second Cthulhu Companion, you know, to show the old school gamers that, you know, we're giving that nod of respect to the past as we move forward. You know, starting with a Lovecraft quote and, you know, the third book in a really old series, you know, because we really didn't know what we wanted in it. You know, are we just going to have some articles? Are we going to have some optional rules? Are we going to have some scenarios? And the answer became yes. We're going to have all of this stuff and we can put it in a companion because that's what the companions were. They were, you know, great little scenarios and alternate rules and maps and prayers and all of this odds and ends. So, you know, we went to Kickstarter and we hit a lot of stretch goals and the book grew. And, you know, we were able to deliver that on time because I didn't have a lot of
experience. Wait a minute. That's not a thing that happens on Kickstarter.
See, I was about to explain. I didn't have a lot of experience with Kickstarter when I started my first one. So nobody told me that 6 months
late,
that 6 months late was technically 3 months early.
Right.
So me in my, you know, anal retentive New York mind frame, you know, mindset is we've taken these people's money. They're kind of like our shareholders. We promised to get this out on time. So we're going to get this out on time if it kills me and all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just put my, you know, my bitch hat on and I made sure that it got done. And it's good because I know a lot of other bitches and they were like, yeah, fuck it. We're going to get this done.
Right.
And we got it done and we got it out. And then everybody was like, oh, my God, it's on time. And I was like, well, why is that special? And then I learned about Kickstarter. And I'm like, oh, so we didn't have to kill ourselves.
Yeah. Well,
fuck it. Now we've set a precedent and we kind of have to.
You poor bastard.
Yeah. Yeah. But honestly, it's I'm such a jerk this way. This is kind of how it would be anyway. Because I can't stand that sort of Damocles hanging over me, that if I've got something to do, it's kind of got to get done. And then until it's done, I'm not free of it. And then, you know, like other people on this, you know, on this program, I keep accepting assignments, when I should know better and to say no. So I just keep making more work for myself. So yeah, the book did well, and we got some great reviews. You know, won a couple of awards. We're really happy with the way things went. So we decided to. Well, at that point, Miskatonic River Press had just completely shut down, even liquidating most of their stock, and they had two books that were in production. When they closed down, there was some scenarios written and there were solid plans, and I got one of the two. I got what little had been written on Tales of the Crescent City, which was our New Orleans collection. Miskatonic River Press had done Tales of the Sleepless City, which was based on a New York campaign I had had. And I'd written like a couple of scenarios for it. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if it was just nothing but New York, you know, urban New York scenarios. So that book did, we were very happy with the way that book turned out. So we wanted to do the same thing for New Orleans, which I love. You know, I love the city. I love the setting. I love the mythos history of it. You know, there's some really good scenarios written there. So we got Kevin Ross involved and a lot of really good people. We got New Orleans Mythos involved, who are a group of local gamers from from New Orleans, and they really helped us pull our history together. We launched that Kickstarter and it did very well. And we delivered that one on time. Although that was a lot harder to do. And unfortunately, thanks to some unpleasantnesses with international redistribution, a year later, I'm still trying to get everyone their rewards. Yeah. But, you know, these things happen, you know. You know, when you deal with things outside of your own house, it doesn't matter how well your house is in order. These things aren't in your house anymore. Right. Next project, everything's going to be in house. You know, I'd rather have myself to blame than chase anyone else.
It's always tricky, you know, because there's, it's a fulfillment issue. So there's always kind of pros and cons, and sort of the pro of outsourcing a lot of that is it frees you up as the project lead to focus on other parts of it. And the con, of course, is there's the risk that if there's a massive hiccup in the fulfillment process elsewhere, then, you know, you don't have hands-on control of it as much. So, right. So it can be really, really frustrating.
Yeah, very. Luckily the fans and the backers have been great. You know, I've tried to be completely honest with what the company is going through, and you know, they appreciate the information and the updates and the honesty. So I haven't had serious backlash.
Yeah. We kind of draw from the same well as far as the audience goes with the Oath and with Delta Green. And a lot of what Arc Dream does too, and yeah, that's always been like the greatest sort of point of grace for all of our projects is our, you know, the audience tends to be really, really nice and really understanding and patient and forgiving, even when we kind of put their goodwill to the test in unconscionable ways.
Oh my God.
So yeah. they're like uniformly, in my experience, just amazingly good people. So that's,
yeah, they are.
Which is one reason we keep, you know, one of the reasons we keep doing what we're doing, even though
you mean keep exploiting them. Is that what we keep doing?
Even when there's like really no rational reason. Like if you were just looking at it in terms of a financial exchange to keep doing a lot of these projects, but it's just sort of so emotionally fulfilling that if you do work that you find good, and then you hear from people that you really like and that you like to work with. Well, they tell
let
you.
Let me throw this out at you. I am hanging out with a friend of mine. And his kids, who are now, you know, because, oh, my God, we're all so old now. Uh-huh. His kids, who are 19 and 20, are talking about, you know, they were raised by gamers. So they got some gaming going on in their lives. And they start talking about, oh, yeah, we're playing some Call of Cthulhu right now. My you know, our so-and-so is running a Call of Cthulhu campaign. And they start describing it. And I suddenly realize that what they're describing is coming full circle.
Oh.
Which was the campaign that John Crow wrote and we published in like 1994.
Right.
Which means that the book is older.
Older than the kids.
The people who are playing it.
Yeah.
And they're having a ball with it. And I'm like, holy shit. Okay. It I'm going to have to bring this back to John and report it. And he's, you know, he does, and instead of jumping up and going woohoo, he just kind of, you know, nods sagely like, yes,
damn, we're old.
As I planned all along, I am one of the immortals for the ages. You know, so that's the thing. That's why you keep dipping into this particular.
I have to just share one bit of wisdom that you know, I didn't get to work with Keith Herber as long as I would have liked, but in the short time I did work with him, he commented, you know, let's just take it easy and we got to have fun with this, because, you know, let's face it, if we're not having, you know, there's no money in this. So if we're not having fun, what's the point?
Right.
And unfortunately, I'm really appreciating how true that philosophy, that old man's philosophy really was moving forward. So, yeah, if you're not, if you don't love this,
yeah,
don't do it. Because, you know, the love's the only thing that's going to keep you doing it.
Right. Right. So, so Island of Ignorance and Tales of the Crescent City, and then, yep.
Those were our... Go on.
Yeah, yeah. Feel free. Go right ahead. I was mostly doing the mental ellipsis there to encourage you to brag about something new.
So we had our two 1920s projects, and I am a huge history nerd, and I love Cthulhu Invictus. It's probably, other than 1920s, my favorite setting.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of reasons. I find it very similar to the 20s because it's, you know, it's a global, you know, it's an international society with good roads and communication and a central bureaucracy. So in a lot of ways, playing in ancient Rome is very familiar. And then you don't have the Judeo-Christian value screwing everything up. So it's a very, very alien society in many ways. So it's just great. You know, me, I always feel like, you know, the mythos has been here for millions of years before man evolved.
Mm-hmm.
So mankind, pretty much since its outset, has been dealing with the Cthulhu mythos. We've been encountering these things forever, you know, since we were here. We've been uncovering them.
We may uncomfortably be them.
Right, right. So, you know, when you get to something like the Roman Empire, first international cross-cultural melting pot society where all of these cultures and languages and societies are meeting, and they're very organized with good records, you know, I like to think that this is where we first started to really, you know, correlate what was going on.
Yeah. Correlate our contents.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Like I liked, in a book I wrote for MRP, we actually have, I guess, a Cthulhu Invictus Delta Green group called the Society of the Hidden Shield. That they were, you know, an organized, you know, inner, you know, cross province society of mythos investigators with cells in major cities and that sort of thing. So yeah, we decided that we were going to do, our third book was going to be a Cthulhu Invictus collection, because if you love a setting, if you don't support it, it's going to go away, you know, or it's just going to be, you know, $200 books on eBay that nobody can really afford. You know, it's going to be a nostalgia game. It's not going to be a living game. And I never wanted that to happen to Cthulhu Invictus. So I wrote for it a lot. And I stumped for it a lot. And, you know, it's – I'm glad that I've done it, because I do love it. And I've – a lot of people all over the world do. So I'm kind of happy that I got a bunch of other – really great authors to, you know, present their vision of what a good Cthulhu Invictus scenario would be. And we decided, as our central theme, we were going to take some of the most cliche, tread upon Lovecraftian tropes and we were going to redo those stories in Cthulhu Invictus. Basically, that's that scenario you've seen 20 times and you're sick of it. We're going to do a completely original Cthulhu Invictus version, and it's going to be awesome. And everybody kind of loved that idea and jumped all over it. So we got some really great people to retell great stories. We have Chad Bowser doing a version of The Doom That Came to Sarnath. Jeff Muller doing Case of Arthur Jerram. I did a Cthulhu Invictus version of The Shadow Over Innsmouth. We have Penelope Love and Mark Morrison doing The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Stuart Boone doing Beyond the, you know, the Mountains of Madness, and he's doing it in Scotland because in the Roman Empire, that's the top of the world. You know, right. That's as far away as you can get. So we have a Scotland scenario, and we have a new author named Fred Groves, and he decided, well, screw this, I'm going to do two great stories, and he did a mashup of Rats in the Walls and Whisper in Darkness. Mm-hmm. In Britannia. So I'm just, you know, super, super excited about this book.
But now, correct me if I'm wrong, but what strikes me is that as a couple of things that are compelling about that idea, that sort of theme that you're working from is both the sort of on the front of it, you know, it's taking those old ideas and those old sort of very often retreaded things and finding new ways to make them compelling and interesting is fun, but also because you're dealing with a setting that is somewhat alien, you know, it actually kind of strikes me that if you sort of start from ground that's kind of common, then that can make presenting the setting a little more accessible as well. And then as the players kind of dig into it, then they're going to find the ways that you're sort of tweaking and rewriting and reinventing the material compelling along the way.
You're absolutely right, but very quickly into these scenarios, it gets completely turned on its head.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you invite them in and they feel safe and familiar because they're thinking, oh, this is Shadow Over Innsmouth. I know how this is going to turn out. And then you shove a bag over their head. You punch them in the stomach and spin them around three times, take the bag off, and they're like, I have no idea what the fuck is going on.
Right.
I have no idea what the hell is going on.
We can say fuck.
Don't worry. There you go.
There are many things will be edited out of this episode. Your foul language will not be one of them.
All right. Well, my stress level significantly dropped. it's a way to kind of get people in, and then they really don't know what's going on quickly because we're not retelling the story. We're telling a version inspired by the story. Right. We're delivering that in a completely unexpected way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So in a way you're right, and then we kind of mix it up, and the players have loved it.
Yeah.
You know, because they've gone in thinking they know what's going to happen, and then when it takes all the left turns, they're like, okay, we're in it now, and we have no idea how this is going to turn out. So it's been a lot of fun in that respect.
Very good.
And that's going well. We're actually pulling it together. We're hoping to have the PDF out in about 6 weeks, which 6 to 8 weeks, which is going to make us late, but only about 2 to 4 weeks late. So I'm not
counting error as these things go.
Right. I'm not killing myself over it. I'm not happy, but I'm not going to, you know, I mean, I'm not an idiot enough to know that, you know, oh my God, we're 4 weeks late. I'm going to be upset about that. You know, I can live with a month late. No. Much more than that, I'd start to really feel itchy, but
In Kickstarter terms, sir, you're actually delivering the product before they've paid you the money. I mean, you're really ruining it for the rest of us.
I can only be me. I you know, I don't know what everybody else is doing. I know what I'm doing.
By the way, I think maybe Scott and I owe an apology to all of Oscar's backers that we're clearly encouraging bad habits and telling them, oh, don't worry about it. Make it 6 months late. They'll love you for it. So
yeah.
he's doing everything he can to do it right. So, right, ignore us and all of our, you know, all of our rationalizing our bad habits.
Don't hurt the cat. Okay, but I'm gonna cue you in on one of the Golden Goblin press secrets on why we can do this. Golden Goblin Press has solid plans to start their fourth Kickstarter on September 9th. We already have authors working.
Yeah.
One of our standing rules is you don't get on the Kickstarter page until I have your scenario.
Right.
Because
yeah,
I love my community, but we're pretty flaky, a lot of us.
We've done that too, and we still get late. Okay, I'm just going to say that has not saved Shane or I ever.
All right. I'm sorry. I was hoping to give you a tip, but no. It's like because I've had people commit and then totally flake out post Kickstarter, and I had to get another author or really give people like three levels of this is your deadline where I'm going to, you know, cast spells on you, and if you miss this one, your next deadline is if I ever see you, I'm kicking you into, you know, a volcano. and literally they missed like three deadlines in a row and said, I don't deal well with structure. And here I am in New York going, you son of a bitch. You know, I'm like literally crawling out of my skin.
Has someone really told you, I don't deal well with structure? Is that words that came out of a mouth that you clearly should have put a fist in?
I shit you not. I actually had an author say that they don't deal well with structure. It's a stressful business we're in.
I'm going to suggest that is an admission that they need a lot of structure.
So there's a blacklist of authors, artists, layout. There's a blacklist of people we won't be working with and would not recommend to other companies. But then again, there's the people that we go to again and again who've delivered, our warrior poets. And those guys will try and get work for any other company that'll hire them. And a lot of our people have gone on to work for other companies after they've been debuted on our, you know, after they've been gotten the exposure from our projects. If you do right by us, we're going to have your back and we're going to try and get you more work. If you can't keep up with us, you know, then we're going to find other people who can. And luckily, a lot of authors, they like the vibe of we're going to put this out and it's going to be out relatively on time. And it's going to be as awesome as a bunch of nerds working on their computers at home can make it. We're really going to do our best. And so other people have said, I really want to write for these guys. So our next project is Tales of the Caribbean, which we're super excited about because it's there. I don't think there are any Caribbean adventures south of Key West, unless you count all the terrible stuff that's been written about the Bermuda Triangle, which we're pretending does. And yeah, I actually had a banned list.
Well, if it's in the 1920s, they're not allowed to use the damn word Bermuda Triangle.
Right.
Because those con men, Berlitz, and has not made it up yet.
Right. When we were accepting pitches, I told, here's the five banned topics we don't want to see: hurricanes, pirates, deep ones, Atlantis, or the Bermuda Triangle.
Did you put sea ghouls in there?
No, we didn't.
Oh my god, I would chafe at the hurricanes because how else am I going to get Ithaca down there?
You know, it was like, if we're trying to do something new. It's a game that's 30, 35 years old.
Right.
Some amazing stuff, a huge backlog. We're better than rehashing
right.
the same old story. And if we're not, we should be. We should be trying to be better. Yeah. So I put out that banned list, and the pitches were brutal. I actually almost didn't get in to my own company, which was hysterical. Because it was blind pitching. I sent it to where the Goblin Council is myself, my chief editor Lisa Paddle, my associate editor Jeff Muller, and our one of our writers and our art director Mark Shireman. So the four of us needed to agree to let a scenario, you know, on whether a scenario got in, and mine was on the maybe list. Because I did, it was like blind pitching, and Jeff's was on the maybe list. And literally, it was bloodbath pitching.
Did you try and sneak in pirates? Was that the problem?
No. Although we did have people violate the list and send in stuff that were like, you know, we said no hurricanes and deep ones.
So here's right. deep ones in a hurricane.
Yeah,
it's good.
It's a deep hurricane.
I was about to say it's going to go Sharknado before you can say Jack Rabbit.
And then everybody was like, "Oh, you're going to do voodoo pirates in Jamaica?" And we're like, "No, because if you thought of it, it's obvious." You know, that's the first thing that comes. If it's the first thing that comes to your head, we don't want to do it. Right. We want to mix it up and offer some surprises and really push our people to be as creative as they can, even if it kills us all. And there are days it feels like it will. But we're really excited about the next project. We're going to be talking about it and handing out promotional stuff, you know, building up some buzz and hopefully have a good turnout to the Kickstarter in September.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Okay, so can I hit you with a pair of questions from the internet?
Anything.
Okay. So Yossi Gervitz over on Facebook asks you, were you surprised at the public support of the Horror Cosmico?
It's weird because it's kind of like I was surprised because I knew it was a risk. Because, I mean, it's Cthulhu Invictus. It's not 1920s. You know, it's not the setting everybody plays. So I was like, I'm really taking a risk to see how many people out there are willing to support a project in this setting. And a lot of people were. So I was surprised at that. But it's kind of like that, you know, if you're a Winona Ryder fan, you think everything Winona Ryder does is great. And you're kind of surprised when other people don't like Winona Ryder. So I love Cthulhu Invictus so much that whenever I find someone not willing to give it a try, I'm kind of like surprised. So I was surprised. I was surprised and I wasn't because I love it so much. Everybody should. But I'm surprised as many people agreed. So I guess I didn't really answer the question.
No, not really.
So the other question you don't have to actually answer is Jeff Moeller says, why does Oscar get to be on podcasts while I slave away proofreading Invictus scenarios? And then he has a little face with the tongue sticking out.
Yeah, he's actually proofreading the last scenario today. I was emailing him earlier. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm on the show. I was asked.
Are you kidding? Jeff. You're filling airtime spectacularly. That's what we asked you on to do, and you were doing it. And 90% of it's on topic. So that
I'm going to let Jeff get away with that because he sends me booze now and again.
I was going to say I really think that's one of those questions that didn't need an answer as much as it just wanted the point made.
They need to be asked.
He is one of our warrior poets. He's one of our go-to slave away anal retentive perfectionists that we love. And it's funny. Him and I are very similar types of writers and in our view of this. So I hadn't really worked with him at all until Golden Goblin Press. And now he's like one of our four. He's on the Goblin Council, you know, helping us, you know, make all of our decisions. He is really, you know, just been a right hand to this.
Yeah, Jeff. I was going to say earlier. It's not a coincidence that, you know, with Golden Goblin's books and the Oath, that there's so much overlap in the author pool, because you can kind of tell the people that are consistently
reliable.
Yeah, and come up with great ideas. And
much like Scum, Cream also rises to the top. So yeah, the good people, you find them and you hold on to them.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky. I've got some really great people. I have my associate editor Lisa is one of these completely overthinking, nitpicky people that is way worse than I am. And I love working with her, because if we can get through a scenario and get to the point where she doesn't see any holes, there are no holes. It's as solid as we can make it, because she'll question everything.
Lisa Paddle was in provided some of the best player generated content in a game scenario ever when I ran at Gen Con. It was a scenario that I tried to record, but there was just the recording was useless, because the players ended up, it just became this thing where everyone just was cracking each other up and falling apart, and the scenario hurled off in directions that could not be controlled, but at the same time, it was again what you call player generated content. There was nothing illogical about which way the scenario went. I can't even describe it, but if you can imagine Lisa playing, of all things, a giant punch drunk ex boxer. That's the setup. You know?
She can play anything. I'm laughing because most people don't know that she's about like 5'4".
Yeah,
she's
5'0".
She's
not a tall Amazon. Yeah.
No, but she'll play. You know, she's played like hard drinking womanizer charioteers in my game. And it's hilarious. You know? She played a murder hobo in one game. You know,
she got the character who was clearly based on Anthony Quinn what's the name of that film with Jackie Gleason that's about the boxing? There's a film about boxing.
Is it The Champ?
No, it's not. I can't remember. I'm not going to remember it. But the basic deal is Anthony Quinn is at the end of his career. He's completely useless. He's just a punching bag. And at this point, Jackie Gleason is betting against him. And because Quinn would not fall down in the right round, now people are going to break Jackie Gleason's legs. And it's an amazing. We'll find it and put it in the show notes. But the great line from that is, you know, when they ask about, you know, when somebody refers to boxing as the sweet science or something like that, or the sport of kings, is Gleason says, "Are you kidding me? If they had enough headroom, they'd hold these things in sewers." So she got the characters based on poor old Billy Mountain, or whatever the character's name was, who was the past his prime boxer, and she was kind of brilliant. She was kind of brilliant in the scenario. Lisa, somebody we've worked, Pagan had worked with her in the past, and on writing projects, on editing and things like that. And she always delivered.
Yeah,
absolutely rock solid. And our just to be fair, so nobody yells at me, although he never would, he's too classy. The fourth member on our council is Mark Shireman, who he wrote a scenario in our first book. He's writing a scenario in the Caribbean book, but he's our he's done our website and does a lot of our promotional art design stuff. And like, what's great to have his opinion is he is a huge LARP writer. He's actually – there's a LARP group called PST Productions that they do Cthulhu Live. So he'd been writing Cthulhu Live forever. So although he didn't write a lot of tabletop, he kind of had that head for free-form chaos of players. So his, you know, his specialty really brought a lot of width, you know, a lot of you know, it helped us really open up that sandbox, because primarily he was a LARP designer, not a tabletop guy, and he brought a lot of that background to the table. When
well, that's sort of interesting. Let me ask a question about that, if I might.
Shoot.
you know, when we think sandbox, we think when I think sandbox, that's what I've always wanted from, you know, from Pagan, was sandbox scenarios where you just, you know, here's the town, here's the problem, here's the area, here's the people, and it go. You know, I'm not going to tell you what scene comes next, you know, and how the story develops. You make the story happen. You're the protagonist. LARPs seem to be the kind of thing that is going to be heavily edited and constrained by your real world budget, so that, you know, your infinite horizon isn't the environment, but your infinite horizon is the players. The individual characters are the things that are going to provide you this wide open field of action.
Right.
And well, that seems like, when you said wrangling chaos, the first thing I thought, I was like, oh my God, yes. How do you control that particular,
through the characters? I really can't speak because I haven't written LARPs, but I've spoken to him about it and I've played in enough of his material to tell you that when they hand out characters, the characters are so well written and so well defined in their thinking and their goals and their background that you kind of are given this whole personality, but you're given enough room to kind of fill in the gaps, but you have the broad picture of who this character is. And they design all of these characters with conflicting goals, in this web of interconnected personal issues. And then they just turn everybody loose in a room and see what happens. It's their LARPs aren't usually, okay, everybody needs to do this. Their LARPs are, you guys, you know, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this 30 times. And then they let these 30 creative people go. And then they just watch and see how everything falls out. And sometimes the way everything falls out, you know, is you know, a lot of gunfire and cannibalism and murder.
If they're doing it right, yeah.
If they're doing it right, people just, you know, unexpected deaths and that sort of thing. But so Mark kind of brings us that, you know, that thought of, we really need to have very strong characters involved in this. And even though he's not, you know, we're not designing the PCs, we're designing the NPCs with so much depth that the players who encounter them are going to love them or hate them or trust them and they probably shouldn't. And the characters, the NPCs and the PCs, they're going to create as much of the chaos of the story than the actual story. Strong characters will really open up sandboxing a great deal. Because once you have them and you know what they're going to do, anything can happen.
Well, the sort of, you know, I would say that the key to any sort of sandbox scenario is the idea that everything's in motion, that, you know, the bad guys have a timetable. They have what they're getting up to, you know, and they're going to keep getting up to it whether you do shit or not, whether you do anything or not. And that sort of aspect of a sandbox where the environment is in motion around the players is sort of key to me, to that environment. So, and you know, the one thing that, I don't know that any of us have done, and I guess maybe it's something we can bring up in our sort of main topic about keeping the mythos unpredictable, is that 99% of everything I've ever read, and I'm trying to remember anything that might step outside this box, is that as far as, you know, the mythos and its unpredictability, the mythos is usually in scenarios and even most of the time in fiction filtered through human agency. There's a human aspect to your contact with the mythos, your cultists, you know, your immortal sorcerer, your corrupted archaeologist, whatever the problem du jour is. A lot of times you've got a human aspect that at its very base, you still are dealing with human desires, human motivations in these scenarios. Very, I cannot think of any published scenarios off the top of my head, and I know we've had this discussion before, where you encounter the raw mythos. Do you know what I mean? Right. Where your encounter is with something absolutely alien and unpredictable and unknowable.
I'm going to challenge you on this. Okay. I don't think you can have that, because unless the players are playing non-human entities, they're going to bring their own humanity into the equation just by dealing with the mythos.
All right.
Because then the story is going to be about how are these humans interpreting, dealing, interacting with. Even if you have no cult and a child gets killed by a mythos entity, you're going to have that child's grieving parents. You're going to have the local police. And it's going to become the mythos as experienced through the humans involved, just because the humans are involved. They may not be helping, they may not have any role in it, but the human condition of being interconnected with other people is going to play into that. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think human interaction is why we're all still playing tabletop and we're, you know, not playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah. Ow. Okay, you elitist snob, who I agree with completely. But at the same time, I guess I'm thinking sort of, you've got a point as far as the aspect of how any story is going to have that human element, because otherwise, how are you even going to communicate it to the reader, even if it was a piece of fiction? But there were a few authors who have there's a few authors post Lovecraft who have managed, in my opinion, to deliver cosmic horror up in a way where it felt like the protagonist is encountering the edge of human perception and the ability to understand what they are encountering and what they are perceiving, and that the raw problem is not a problem of creepy loser decides to use supernatural plutonium to have a bigger dick or more money or a nicer car or a prettier wife or whatever pathetic monkey motivations it would encourage someone to muck around with hypergeometry or whatever you want to call it, this alien technology. But it is just simply a raw encounter with the carnivorous universe in which we live.
Well, for adventures, it's the challenge is that you're dealing with player characters who are human beings, because you've got to start somewhere in telling the players what they're playing. And then at the same time, you've got these characters that are kind of pre-existing and you need some way to bring them in contact with the horribleness. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of default for that is some other human being who's not your human beings is coming in contact with this. And because you're both human, it gets sort of transmitted. You hear about it in some way or whatever. And that's the kind of easy way to do it. And so if you're especially in an ongoing game, if every adventure is these same characters kind of come in contact with this horrible supernatural thing that just happens out there, then it begins to really strain credulity. And so you've got to have some kind of recurring way for them to...
It's also considerably less fun. I mean, you look at the... Like, maybe the color out of space is the most, you know, alien of all his stories. And, you know, it comes out to be... So there's this thing that you can affect that, you know, is going to hang out for a while and then is going to leave and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't stop it. You can't encourage it to leave quicker. You know what I mean? It's...
Your methods are really different than fiction than in a role playing game, right? Your challenges are very different. You have to keep the ways that you keep the audience, or to say the players, engaged and invested is really different. And if in a story the reader can be kind of passive and can see the characters as being passive, and if it's written well enough and it kind of is weird enough, then you can get away with that. But if you're around a table, that the dynamic is totally different, so you can't really, yeah.
Well, I mean, a color out of space scenario in the game, having played and run several of those, they kind of have a similar structure. But I mean, the scenario isn't about stopping the evil. It's the real. It's one, discovering the cause of the illness, you know, the blight on the land, and two, the uncovering, learning that you can't affect it. That's the point of the story, is that or those scenarios that, oh god, we can't do anything about it. Like, that's the twist at the end, is like, oh, okay. And then maybe trying to survive or escape that. So it's a survival horror investigation sort of thing, but it's not stopping it. But like, that's the whole idea in A Color Out of Space, is that, oh, we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, well,
it
is one of those times where the players actually encounter that aspect of the mythos, where it is, you realize you're completely outclassed and you're not going to be able to shake your monkey fist in defiance in any effective way. I mean, you can do it, you still get devoured, you know.
Well, I mean, in some scenarios, like on Monograph, like Machine Tractor Station 37, the players can futilely try. So it's, you know, they don't necessarily know that per se. So they rig up some sort of machinery to try and draw out the color. So.
But anyway,
shoot that spot. Go for it.
I often find that when you have players in a situation like that, where they really are discovering that they are complete, that all of their efforts are going to be completely ineffectual, there's a knee-jerk reaction that they feel like they've been put in a Kobayashi Maru. So right. I often find that those types of scenarios are best for certain types of players, but they don't go over. There's a definite risk of them not going over so well.
Yeah, you've got to find some other way to make it worth the discovery.
Right,
because players are playing a game, and when you're playing a game, you're looking for solutions. And so
needs to be an achievable goal.
Right. If you come to a point where the big reveal is you're not going to solve this, then you've got to have something else that's kind of satisfying that the players can sink their heads into.
Right.
They're going to come away from it feeling like they've really run into something that was sort of awe-inspiring or sort of creepy or chilling, and that was worth sitting around the table, even though they found that they couldn't solve the Rubik's Cube in the end.
Yeah, and admittedly, you know, the idea that you got out of it with your skin intact is sometimes that often is not presented as a victory. Do you know what I mean? That getting out of it with your skin intact, players will often feel that somehow, you know, either we failed or we were gypped, mm-hmm. you know? And, sometimes, because, you know, as much as I flinch and wince at things like Artifact Zero, the scenario that Dennis wrote, sometimes horrible things like that are necessary to remind people that you are in an unforgiving, uncaring, unpleasant, nasty game world that isn't going to do your player characters any favors.
I mean, a lot of times a playable challenge still emerges, even if it's just like Ross is saying, if the challenge doesn't become, can we fix this? If the challenge then becomes, oh, we've found that we can't fix this. Now, can we survive this? You know, can we escape in some way? And
the goal can be minuscule. The goal can be as big as saving one person. But as long as there's something achievable, the players will accept that they've done something, you know, or recovered some information, or, you know, they need something more than just coming away alive. Coming away alive and leaving the threat, most players are going to treat that as a push.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and of course, the other side of that is if your goal as a designer is to present a scenario that doesn't have a solution, then you need to make sure that what the players do come away with is an experience that's kind of, you know, interesting and compelling and creepy enough that they felt like the experience was worthwhile.
Right. Yeah.
I actually have a couple of Kobayashi Maru scenarios.
Yeah.
And when I run them, I tell people, don't think of this as a puzzle to solve. Don't think of this as a maze to find your way out of. This is who you are. This is where you are. Live out the next 48 hours the best you can. When you tell that to players, they're usually like, oh, yeah, this is going to be a ride. Let's bring it on. And they know, okay, this is something different. Let's just do this. And
So Ross, do I need to lay that out before the next scenario we play at Gen Con? Because you and the rest of the RPPR people are going to be playing members of the Islamic State, and you're on a mission to smash artifacts and videotape it.
Yeah, it's not going to go well.
Do I need to have that set up that Oscar had, or can you just smell the chum in the water from the get-go?
I will,
because I believe that's what's going to be waiting for your people in July.
Yeah.
Is you're going to get to play Islamic State fighters.
The adventure I have with Kobayashi Maru is everybody is a member of the Japanese military in 1945 on an island garrison where an amphibious landing is about to take place.
Mm.
And I think this story only really ends it ends a number of ways, but it only really ends one way. It's not going to end well for you. So I tell people, look, don't think of this, you know, just this is who you are, where you are, this is what's going on, and just live it, own it, and let's see where we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can always, in horror gaming especially, you can set up scenarios that are, you are the red shirts, you know, as long as everyone's upfront about it and everyone accepts this premise going into it. I mean, sometimes you do have
presence.
Situations.
It's a glorious premise, because at that point, especially if it's like a con round one shot, it's like, okay, it's kind of like, okay, we're just going to rock this out. You get this, freedom of fatalism that no matter what I do, it's not going to matter. So I'm just going to live. And I find that players who have that, you know, that sense of this is the end of my destiny, really play balls to the wall and totally get into it. So as long as they have that mindset that this is the last day of my life, you know, whether it is or it isn't, they're going to really enjoy that. And I think it's the expectation that sets this up to fail or to succeed.
Mm. Well, we're sort of in the ballpark of where we were going to be with this main topic. That was keeping the mythos unpredictable. But I wanted to go ahead and try and round back to some of the challenges that we face with the mythos, with Call of Cthulhu, and some of the things that Shane had pointed out pre-show. One of the big problems, of course, is that we are limited. We're dealing with a limited body of work as far as the fiction goes that this stuff is based on. And sans actually inventing new critters or great old ones or whatever, there is a point where people who've been playing for 20 years, because you can have been playing for, what is it, 34 years now? Was it 1981, I guess it was? So we're
33 for me this year, I think.
Yeah. So since you got people who can be playing for that long, they're intimately familiar with all of the fiction, with all of the gaming material. How can you manage to deliver something that's not, you know, oh, it's ghouls again, mm-hmm. and and everyone knows what to do next in that situation. Even if their characters don't have the knowledge, there's still that problem of player knowledge that can bog things down. So, Mr. Ivy, because you appear first in the show notes, I was hoping that maybe you could delve into that topic a little bit more.
Well, at least I can give some, some things to people other people to talk more wisely about. But I mean, the way I sort of lay it out is, when you're designing this before you're actually at the table playing, then your options, to my mind, you really have two options, right? You're either going to present a new, present an old threat of some kind and disguise it in such a way that it's not recognizable. Or you're going to just make something up completely from scratch. And both of those kind of has challenges. I'm presenting an old threat and changing the details until the players don't know what they're dealing with is in a lot of ways easier, because the stat block's just right there. You don't have to make everything up from scratch. You just change the change the details, change the description around some, change the vulnerabilities and or how it attacks, how it preys on people. And if you sort of go through, make a checklist, and sort of scratch out something that's there already and replace it with some other little piece of factoid, then you can go a long way. And Ken Height talks about this issue a lot in Trail of Cthulhu and in his series. Ken writes about stuff that I've encouraged people to go to time and again for this very reason, where he kind of takes apart the Hounds of Tyndalos, say, goes back to the original material and kind of represents them in a way that can seem fresh, because what we're so accustomed to is what's in the rule book, and where they actually came from was something a little different than what we've all seen all these years. I think that's something that's the easiest thing to, in terms of, it takes less time than to just sort of come up with something from scratch and hope that it's as good as all these awesome things that have already been written about.
Right? Well, I find a spell list on a monster that is is the shortcut to that. That, all I have to do is, if the rule set says my critter can have however many spells, I'll go ahead and say, hell, we'll max that out. Let's pick out some spells that give the critter a whole new set of capabilities. Mm-hmm. And mixing, making the monsters mythos sorcerers is a huge, to me, it's a huge way to not exactly redesign an old threat, but certainly to re-equip the old threat. You know what I mean? Just to give it... Yeah. A different toolbox with which to bedevil the players with.
Right. But what without... it means is to my mind, you really, if you want to keep the players in suspense, you've got to couple that with shifting things around from, you know, shifting the details around. I mean, if you're in an if you're in a scenario and the big, when the big climax happens, it's a giant slimy thing that's kind of shaped like a tree with tentacles and mouths, right? We all know exactly what we're dealing with. You know, we all know exactly what the stats are going to look like. And then the challenge is, how do I pretend to be ignorant of that? You know, and that's taking up the headspace that I could be spending on being scared of the thing that's unknown.
I'm gonna build on what you guys are saying. I think that, again, I think exploring the spell list and mixing up exactly what the capabilities of the creatures are is a brilliant way to go. What I like to do is really put myself into, as best I can, the creature's headspace.
Mm-hmm.
And play with the creature's evolution, play with the creature, you know, not like physical evolution, but cultural evolution. You know, are the ghouls in New England the same as the ghouls in Peru? Mm-hmm. Are the sand dwellers in the Middle East the same as the sand dwellers in the center of the United States? You know, what are serpent men like in, you know, in Australia as opposed to India? You know, give these creatures some cultural differences, give them some individual motivations, and suddenly they become a lot more interesting and dynamic. You know, now you're not so much wondering how many hit points they have, what are their armor class, you know, how are we, what are they immune to? Now you're wondering, is this even friend or foe anymore? You know, what is this creature? Because it's not acting or behaving in a way that I'm expecting it to, because, you know, you're metagaming. And I've done that a bunch of times. I've used creatures and I said, well, this particular tribe of X, because they live here, so close to here, and they've been exposed to this, they've developed this kind of a cultural quirk. So then when the players are interacting with them, there is an unexpected difference.
Certainly that's what happened with the ghouls in New Orleans that I wrote up for Delta Green. The DeMont plan was the ghouls who can't live underground. They can't burrow into cemeteries because the water table is right there. Yet they're living in a city that is the number one abattoir in America. It's the corpse factory of America for the whole 19th century. You can't walk away from that. Mm-hmm. But you can't live the culture that ghouls have lived for millennia. That is to say
That's more feasible, especially if you're dealing with a monster that's tightly bound to humanity the way ghouls are.
To just jump in on your ghouls, I've worked on something set in Peru that hopefully will be out soon. And my ghouls, the ghoul pack that I wrote about in Lima, exists in their vast catacomb systems, which is directly under the major cathedral. So I had my ghouls listening, you know, to the echoes of mass decades, you know, in and out, in and out, in and out. And then one ghoul wandered into the cathedral dressed in human clothes and tried to go to confession and wanted to know if he had a soul. So I probably made the only devoutly Catholic ghoul pack on the face of the earth.
Well, look at some
again,
of these.
My players are like, what the hell? You know, these ghouls are dressed as monks. You know, who the fuck are these guys? But I had my backstory. So I took something as run-of-the-mill as ghouls, and I just turned it on its head with the culture and the setting and the history.
Yeah.
And my players had absolutely no idea how to deal with these guys, which was great.
I keep hoping that one day I can find the time to return to the ghoul cult that worships Stalin as the great provider.
The great provider.
Yeah, yeah.
I really hope we can find time to come back to that because, gee, things have not necessarily gotten any better in Russia over the last 10 years. So maybe there'll be room for that. But again, it's easy to do with ghouls and deep ones and other aspects of the mythos that are closely tied to humanity.
I want to see you write a ghoul scenario written during the Serbian-Croatian conflict. When they had those mass burial genocide pits,
yeah,
I'm guessing those ghouls had a ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I what I wonder about is, the thing that sort of makes me wonder is because I hear friends who've worked in the tech industry, particularly in the game industry, and they're literally tech hobos right out of your islands of ignorance. And by the way, Oscar, the two parts that I immediately read was your When Johnny Comes Marching Home and your section on hobos, which I was both thrilled with because two huge aspects of the classic Cthulhu era that are vastly underrated, underlooked after, to me, is the veteran, the Great War veteran, and the massive migrant labor that we had in this country for so long. And
thank you.
There was a time when that whole idea that you move to chase the job. The only people who are doing that, as far as I can tell now, are people in the computer game industry. Those poor bastards seem to have to move after every project closes. And I wonder if perhaps there's something going on with the ghouls, where as our traditional means of burial have changed over the last century, if there isn't perhaps ghoul migrations where they just turn on CNN and find out where, the latest conflict zone is, where are the monkeys making the most bodies, making the most food, and they somehow have managed to either, I don't know, through the dream lens is the cheap, easy answer. But they can migrate to wherever the latest trouble spot is in order to keep up on their diets.
I love that. I actually have a scenario where three of the PCs are ghouls, and their big problem is the cemetery they live in just built a crematory. And they're terrified that cremations are going to slash the number of incoming bodies available to be fed on.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one of their major conflicts in the game.
What scenario is this?
It's not published yet. I've got a bunch of stuff that's just hanging. I run it at cons.
Yeah. I know my co-host for RPPR, Tom Church, would love to play that scenario.
Yeah.
We are running I'm running the laundry later this year, and he is. They have rules for playing a ghoul as a character in the laundry.
The characters in one are three ghouls, a cemetery worker who's a necrophiliac, a serial killer who's a cultist of Haster, and a rat thing who's bound to a undead sorcerer who's been waiting, who's ordered the rat thing to protect his body until end times, and after two centuries the rat thing is just completely fed up and is trying to get someone to destroy the undead wizard just to be free, and the trick as soon as they threaten the undead wizard, he's going to be honor bound to protect him, so he's kind of like, go kill this guy but lock me up first.
I want to point out that the least loathsome character so far is the ghouls.
Yeah,
out of that lineup, the least loathsome group would actually be the necromages. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's called Life After Death. I've been running it at cons for years. That's the scenario. Everybody's like, oh, we're all going to hell for having so much fun playing this.
Shane, before you have to check out for the rest of the podcast, let's make sure to get the complete info dump from you before you abandon Oscar to me and Ross.
Which info dump is that?
Well, again, the sort of the ideas we talked a little bit about the idea that you've got to ways of trying to
keep
resurrect old problems in ways that they can be fresh and new. I was just curious if you had some other ideas about that. You mentioned going clear earlier in the and I thought perhaps
notes. what he's talking about is I wrote in the in our little show notes document that we kind of compare notes in some recommendations for sort of getting inspiration from the real world on creating really weird sort of terrifying things for your players. And for me, I mean, I like every just about every day or every other day I post some link to a science article or something from the news that I find just really creepy or interesting on the Delta Green Facebook list and kind of collect those things for big posts on the website from time to time. Because, you know, every day there's something new that has implications that I find completely creepy. In physics or medicine or you know, actual real world cults doing terrifying.
And every foot we roll back the ice shelf is another scenario just waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Yet another of these giant methane plumes that turns into a huge-ass hole in the ground in Russia. I just last night watched Going Clear, the documentary about Scientology that's on HBO now, which is it doesn't really break any hugely new or reveal anything new that if you've been following Scientology for a while, you've probably heard about it or read about it or whatever, but it kind of brings it all together in this one, you know, not quite 2 hour package of horribleness, you know. And but that alone is a source for great inspiration for scenarios, because you can kind of look and see when you've got this kind of insular, tightly bound group, occult beliefs, occult in the sense of supernatural and also in the sense of tightly, you know, very secret and secretive, you can kind of see, well, in the real world, we know exactly what that looks like and what happens when they're kind of, you know, self-destructing in a huge way in Waco or Jonestown, or trying to remain mainstream and profitable, even if it's a nonprofit, allegedly, with Scientology. And of course, in Delta Green, that became enormous.
No, it wasn't. We were in no way making any commentary on legitimate beliefs of the Scientologist's trademark, L. Ron Hubbard.
Right, yeah. John Scott Tynes, Seattle, Washington, is who your lawyers ought to talk to.
Yeah.
But I put a note in there because Mike Daisy is a friend of Scott, you know, and your wife Jane. You guys go back with him, you know, in the whole pagan.
Well, he introduced us, so there you go.
Well, there's that too. Anyway, so he and my wife Rachel and Mike's wife Jean Michelle met for the first time a few years ago in Atlanta. And had dinner, and it was really, really fun. But this was before he got sort of internet infamous for his Apple expose and show that he, you know, that turned out some of the material that he talked about or described in his story as sounding factual, he said was, you know, factual.
I like to be a dick and say that Mike basically said, there's a couple parts of that show where he said, yeah, I was totally the guy who said, oh, the humanity, when the Hindenburg blew up. That turns out not to be true, which some people have said clearly that proves the Hindenburg did not blow up.
Right.
That's sort of the chain of logic that has followed the whole Apple doesn't employ creepy Chinese factories that, you know, throw human rights and human dignity right out the window.
Yeah. I mean, that was an aside. That has nothing to do with what I was going to say. It was just when we met, this was before that all happened.
Yeah.
And before that, the thing that he had kind of apparently gotten the most grief about was talking about L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology and his monologue, Great Men of Genius, which was an absolutely brilliant monologue, and you can download it free online, and it's totally worth listening to. But the thing that reminded me of that after seeing Going Clear was when Rachel and I met Mike and Jean Michelle and had dinner with them, it was after a show that he had done about called The Last Cargo Cult, where he had talked about the cargo cults in the Pacific.
Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, which especially. that's its own whole other fascinating topic. But during this show, and I don't know if I may be talking out of school because I haven't gotten his permission to say this out loud. So apologies if that's the case. And we'll go excise this out of the recording if Mike says, how dare you, sir. But after the show, when we met, he described during the show, apparently there was somebody in the audience in this little Atlanta theater. And this was a show where there wasn't like a stage per se. It was basically on the floor, and the seating began on the floor on the same level as the performer, but about 15 feet back. And then kind of there were risers above that. So it's all kind of surrounding this little miniature amphitheater that seats a couple of hundred people. So it's Mike at his desk, and then the people he's talking to, 15 feet away, kind of in a semicircle, and then rising above him beyond that. But during the show, apparently, there was a guy who had come to the show with a date. And this guy spent the entire show from 15 feet away glaring at Mike and trying to keep eye contact and over and over mouthing things like, I hate you. You're horrible. You suck. I hate you. You shouldn't be here. Like very clearly mouthing these incredibly hostile things. And, because Mike's been doing this a long time, he's a pro. He didn't let it get to him. He kept doing his show. But, Jean Michelle, who was directing the show, knew what was happening. She could tell the guy was there, and it was making her really nervous. Like, is this dude going to do something violent, right? What's actually happening here? And during the show, apparently the guy's date was getting on his case and telling him, quit doing this, right? It was the weirdest thing. And after the show, the guy just got up and left. And they were trying to kind of decipher it afterward. What in the hell just happened? And the only thing that made any sense to it was this must have still just been blowback from Mike's Scientology show from a couple of years before that.
It's too early to be a Mac user. So yeah. It must be one of the Scientologists because no one gets mad when he says bad things, bad but true things about Thomas Edison.
Right, right. So anyway, seeing the documentary just kind of brought that back to mind, and because that was a real life thing that was just so inexplicable and strange. And that's the kind of thing that if you're wanting to tell a story or make a scenario and make it feel really, really weird and creepy, there's a great ingredient you can just put in and you hardly even have to tweak it to make feel freaking out if that happens to one of their characters.
That's right. That feels like that thing that Stolze suggested at Gen Con, which was you go someplace completely new, you'd put your character, the player someplace completely new, and everybody intimately knows them.
Right.
Yeah, where the opposite of somebody who's, well, I guess it's sort of the same aspect of that. That kind of hatred seems stunningly personal, and yet it's a complete stranger.
Well, I think the key is to have an enigma, a mystery, an inexplicable, seemingly mundane, but just there's no motive behind it. There's something like that. But to have it to be inexplicable, to have no explanation.
No explanation for the players or no explanation for the keeper.
Yeah, and to have something that's unsolvable.
Unsolvable for the players, but does the keeper know what's going on? Because nothing annoys me more than, why did that happen? Because it was weird. It would freak you out.
Well, I think it can happen too. Like, I think there's a really good, like, it to the degree to which you explain it kind of varies. Like, for example, Night Floors, Dennis Detwiller's great scenario about Carcosa, haunted house scenario. There's a lot of weird shit that happens in it, and it's never explained. Except
Carcosa. Well, that's the explanation I need. As long as I understand, oh, it's Carcosa. That's why the guy is crying tiny golden snakes. Good, done. Yeah. That, you know, but to find out that, you know, why is he crying tiny golden snakes? I thought that would be really weird. Oh, you know that.
Yeah, no. There, yeah, that, yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing that really works for a scenario. You can't go too far in it. It has to be consistent with the major premise of the scenario. You can't, like, for example, throw that in if it's not a Carcosa scenario. Unless the character's hallucinating, like, you know. But that's a whole.
That'll be one of the things that an editor instantly cuts when you're over your word count. Like yeah, why is exactly, this here? Yeah. Okay, we just got 200 more words gone.
Yeah, if you're going to, never go full David Lynch. Never go inland.
No kidding.
Blue Velvet's okay. Maybe some of Mulholland Drive, maybe not Inland Empire.
And not Fire Walk With Me. Okay? Not fucking Fire Walk With Me. That was one that was just filled with, yeah, that's happening because David Lynch thought it would be weird. There's nothing else going on there that I am able to hang my hat on. And if he has some hidden meaning, I'm a relatively perceptive, you know, moviegoer, but I'm still not getting it.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of say what the fuck now.
You can only it's a light touch too, like you have one moment like that in there. Like, again, my favorite, like, sometimes it could never be explained at all, except, like, for example, Caleb Brand, one scenario he made up called Lover in the Ice, that was about a Delta green box that got compromised, and we had to go and, like, do inventory for a green box. And I've told this story before, but, like, we find this green box is a storage unit that's been around for decades, and so we're pulling these boxes out and, like, what's in this one? All right, you pull it out. There's a parrot in it. There's a cage and there's a parrot in it. The parrot's alive. It's just a normal parrot. What? This place has been locked up since the 70s. You're saying there's a parrot in a fucking cage and it's alive and it looks normal. Like, I'm scared to death of this parrot. I'm not going to risk killing it or trying to shoot it or anything. I'm afraid more than of the monster in the scenario. Please God, let never that cage open. That was never explained, but that kind of works. Because that was the one time it happened.
Though, yeah. Because you've been set up for it. You're willing.
Yeah.
The idea that this thing has been dropped off in this oubliette, you know, this storage unit oubliette. You know what? We don't know how this thing works. Fuck it. Let's hope this never becomes important. And they just
I've got to share a story that's almost exactly the same thing. I had a group of investigators find an old Crusader tomb. And in the tomb, they find out it's not really a tomb. It's a vault where the Crusaders hid certain things they didn't want found. And one thing they found was a box. And inside the box was a single silver denarius from I think, Tyre. And in Latin on the box was one of 17. And the characters were like, one of 17? Is this one of the 17 pieces of silver that Judas betrayed? And the characters were like, don't touch it. Put it down. Back away. No good can come from this. And they were more scared of that one coin than anything else in the scenario. And I had nothing. I had nothing written, no background. It was just a little throwaway. It was just a box in a tomb, but because of the implications, they were absolutely terrified. So I could see this apparently immortal parrot in a box scaring the ever living piss out of people, just because, you know, what it could be, not even what it is.
Yeah, Yeah, and certainly the players are going to likely imagine something far worse than you had planned for. So there's always, you know, the idea that if you don't want to reveal because you're going to have that 10-foot cockroach problem where, you know, they're like, oh, it's a 10-foot cockroach. Thank God. I was worried it was going to be 20 feet, you know, and you'll shoot, you'll be under their expectations. But as far as Mythos critters go, and Mythos problems, the thing that I find it's one of the easier ways to keep some of this stuff fresh is, or at least it seems to be a way to keep it fresh, is to is being a history nerd and always finding new settings. We've done some stuff, some stuff that's unpublished as of yet for the Wild West. We've done some stuff that's unpublished where the players play Arapaho Indians on the plains of America in the 1820s and 1830s. We got one that was set during the Underground Railroad, where you play abolitionists during Bleeding Kansas, and the changing the setting and changing the historical perspective does a good job of keeping the Mythos critters fresh and exciting, just because they're sort of, they seem to end up being dressed up in different skins, just based on the time period they're presented in. You know what I mean?
I absolutely agree.
Go ahead.
The only time I ever wrote a MIGO scenario, and of course, it's like one of those scenarios you kind of have to write. It's everyone writes their MIGO scenario.
Yeah.
My MIGO scenario takes place in the Blue Mountains of Kentucky, 20 years after the Civil War. And so I just took them completely out of you know, New England, and in a historical period that was completely alien, you know, for the players. And my agent was a snake oil salesman, and everyone liked him because his potions worked. And he was a MIGO agent who was allowed to do some good for the human community in the area by selling them, you know, space age pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
And just made, you know, he didn't need to do it, but that was one of the trade-offs that the MIGO allowed him to do. He could still go on these little snake oil trips, as long as he kept people out of the mountains. And that guy dies. So now there is no watchdog on the MIGO. And that's how, you know, the scenario starts.
Or watchdog on the human herd.
Right, watchdog on the human herd. But it was, and again, it's a scenario where as the players are discovering this whole thing, you know, they've never heard of the MIGO. There's no rumors about this mountain or there's no ancient legends. It's just that this property, it's private property. The whole mountain's owned by something called the greater FY mining of Greater Kentucky. And it's off limits. And, you know, it's interesting because it's presenting a classic in a way that hadn't been done before. And I've run it a few times and it always comes off very unexpectedly. And then, you know, you find your first body, you know, with no brain, and the hardcore players are like, oh wait, this is this. But they're in such a weird place and they're in such a weird period and the motivations are so different that even though they know it's MIGO, they really don't know how to react. Mm-hmm. And in that game, I have usually 1/3 of the players becoming MIGO agents, and the other 2/3 either trying to run away or kill that 1/3. So it's usually the players fighting each other than actually fighting the MIGO.
Ah, well, 9 o'clock, time for the PC firefight. Everyone get out your guns and stand in a circle.
Because, you know, the MIGO need new agents. And, you know, you can live in this house with, you know, electricity and running water and, you know, and an icebox that doesn't need ice. And, you know, these phonographs that show pictures. You know, so I made this great little steampunk mountain cabin. And the players are like, I want to live here forever. And then the MIGO show up. Well, you can. We just need you to keep humanity off the mountain.
Yeah, I have that same problem with my Hollow Earth Expedition players. They have an Achilles heel called knowing stuff, and they have uncomfortably cooperated with Nazis and other secrets. Anytime somebody shows up and says, "I have some secret knowledge," everybody's like, "Oh yes, we want that," you know.
And then they bring back the letter. This is the agreement the MIGO have signed, so there'll be peace. Like, okay, Chamberlain, good job. Waiting.
I was always very happy with that bit from the very first Miskatonic River Press thing with the guy who's the mayor, and in order to keep him quiescent or keep him on their side, the MIGO have kidnapped his children's bodies,
yes,
but left the brains in the house in jars.
And he's
reading bedtime stories to the jars, having unplugged the vocal speakers because he got tired of the screaming.
I love that. I was one of the first people to play that. That was a great scenario. That was the one scenario I remember that all the players were like, we're going to have to go upstairs and look through all this creepy stuff. And we're like, yep. So the players said, okay, well, we're just going to sit here for a minute. And we all smoked a cigarette and passed a flask around before we went any further. It's like, all right, we're going to enjoy this last moment of life and sanity before we go upstairs or go into the basement. And they're like, all right, well, I'm just going to take out a pack of cigarettes. Anybody want one? It's like we just stopped the game to have our characters catch their breath.
Yeah, because at this point, what's a cigarette going to do to you? I mean,
right.
You know, like, really, a cigarette? I'll have six, please. You know, just. As far as, you know, again, we're, you know, to the idea of reskinning things or.
Right, that was a perfect example.
Yeah, you know, making them.
It's completely logical for what the MIGO.
Yeah, it's absolutely within all of the boundaries that were set up by the fiction and the game material.
Right,
and it was just something that we'd never seen done before. The idea that the idea of that level of coercion, and it also did a charming job of demonstrating both the ruthlessness of the MIGO, the callousness of the MIGO, and their complete lack of understanding. Because, you know, what's the mayor going to get back if, by some miracle, they actually do put the brains back in the kids? Heaven forbid they get the wrong brain in the wrong head. You know what I mean? And as far as they're concerned, as far as human biology goes, oh, two brains back in head, you know, what's the big deal? You know, they fixed it, right? Even if you get your brain, the kids' brains back in their head, they're gone. You know, they've been trapped in this sort of isolation. Yeah.
There's no coming back from that.
Yeah.
not right, anyway.
Even if the MIGO somehow think, well, we totally dealt square with him. You know, we gave him his kids back. I mean, right? We gave him his genetic, you know, prodigy back. Problem solved. You know, it also did a great job of showing kind of their incomprehension of us, you know, that they don't really get us either, you know.
But you can take it the other way, that they're not even thinking that far ahead. They're just like, well, if this shuts him up, fine. Like, they haven't even – like, you can say that they have so little empathy and so little sense of human understanding. They were like, well, if this keeps him under control, then fine. And they're like, well, what about – putting the brains back, and they'd be like, well, why would we do that? The situation's contained. The ignorant monkey thing is in his place. Let's just move on with what we're doing.
Yeah, clearly when it's time for them to go, the idea that they would put the why would they follow through on the agreement, you know, when the time came? Why would they bother if it's a situation where they're just going to pack their little, you know, biomechanical bags, carpet bags, and leave when they're done? Right. Yeah, there's no point in them putting yeah. things right. But say that there was, you know, but even the idea that, you know, well, you know, now that we'll put the brains back at some point, because, you know, that way he'll be our willing servant, because he'll be grateful or something, you know. They just don't even, you know, their thinking comes off as wildly alien to me, because they wouldn't think anything of having their brain separated from their body, whatever, you know.
Right.
Well, they can, you know, they can hack that, you know, standing on one pseudopod, and it's no big deal, but it completely breaks us, you know. And you know, again, I've always liked Dennis's idea that the Miko, despite the fact that they've interacted with humans for a long time, they, in a lot of ways, they just don't get us. We're just as incomprehensible to them.
It's kind of like humans and dogs. We've domesticated them. They've been our companions for 20,000-25,000 years. You know, I think there's one guy on cable that really gets Got Dogs, and the rest of us are kind of clueless. You know,
I think you may be setting humanity awful high on the scale of things if you're comparing us and the Migo to dogs and humans. I think we probably fit below dogs somewhere. But all right, fair enough.
It's in the ballpark. Okay, it's like
I think
they've been dealing with us this long. They know how to deal with us. They know how to train us. They really don't understand our society, but it doesn't matter, because they understand us well enough to control us.
Yeah, yeah. If they absolutely have to keep us off the furniture, they'll use a shock collar.
Right. You know? Exactly. Yeah. I like to think of the relationship that way.
All right. Anyways, the other thing you mentioned early on, Oscar, and I'm sorry, Ross. You wanna go first?
Yeah. Well, I've talked about one other technique. Please. For keeping up the mythos, and that's a lot of one thing is that, you know, Cthulhu Mythos games tend to be pretty front loaded in that, hey, if you're running a game called Call of Cthulhu or something like that, maybe that gives players a little hint about what's to come. And it should, but you can vary it by trying to hide it. I mean, or since, you know, sort of do a little bit of misdirection. Like, my example would be a Knights Black Agents game I ran, a campaign called Tribes of Tokyo. And from the very beginning, it was actually inspired by a post on the Delta Green mailing list about the Long Vault, which, if you remember, that is basically about the San Chan Empire and the sorcerers who are like, hey, we need psychics in the future. So I'll send a message to my past self to go and, like, kidnap a bunch of psychics, reduce them to their essential salts, and go store them in a vault somewhere so that I can pull them out in 5,000 years. And so I came up with the idea that that's what was happening in Tokyo, but the guy was using drugs to make people psychic, and then he was creating vampires through ritual magic to do his bidding. And but the idea, so the players only came into this as basically being a private espionage agent, you know, security contractors who stumble across vampires, they get burned, and so they have to go underground to find out what the hell's going on. And so it's literally out of 13 sessions, I don't introduce or let them deliberately know that there's Cthulhu Mythos elements until the ninth session of the campaign, much to Caleb's chagrin. He's like, son of a bitch, you know. I thought you were going to do it. I thought it was going to be. No,
the best Call of Cthulhu game I ever had was during a Traveler game.
Yeah, exactly.
It just completely blindsided during a Traveler game. And I'm like, and it creeped me out forever. It really did.
Yeah.
Very effective.
And that's the kind of thing. I mean, sometimes with players, you kind of have to do that to get them in the same mood as their player characters, who are the player characters don't know that they're playing Call of Cthulhu, or at least at the beginning. So you kind of have to do that by switching up the game, you're running in maybe in a universal system, or in a, you know, something related, and then kind of like, ha-ha,
I think you're, if you've got players that are really thinking about the material, and if you're going to run it where you're keeping them engaged, you're keeping them interested, you're keeping them focused on the mystery, the information, the witnesses. By the time something supernatural happens, they're so focused on what they've been delving into that it almost can come, even at that point, can come as a shock. Like, I've had people playing stuff set in World War II or stuff set in the Dark Ages or the Roman Empire or the Old West that they're playing this for about an hour or so, and they're playing, you know, an Old West game, or they're playing a World War I game, and then someone gets up from the dead, or somebody bursts into flames, or a Bayaki shows up, and they're like, holy shit. And then I've actually had players tell me, you know, I kind of forgot we were playing Call of Cthulhu for a while.
If I can manage to get them to forget the game system they're in, that's one of those achievements, very, very rare achievements.
It can be done. It can be done. If you can, a lot of it's with the quality of the players that they're just completely immersed in their story. And when the supernatural happens, it can be jarring. Like, I have a game where everybody's hobos, and they're so focused on getting on and off the train, dodging the railway.
The cinder bowls, yes.
Right, and, finding alcohol, because some of them are bums, that they're alcoholics, that when the supernatural stuff starts, they're like, I thought we were just in a hobo game. I kind of forgot we were playing Call of Cthulhu. Okay, yeah. Let's deal with the supernatural. And for a minute, it's just like, you know, like that grinding of transmission. That like, what? Mm-hmm. But again, it's a matter of focus and pacing and really engagement, I think.
Yeah. Now,
if you got players that are just sitting there for 3 hours waiting for the other shoe to drop, I think they're kind of missing the point, and they're doing themselves a disservice.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to relax and go with the story and live it.
Certainly, John Crow's trick, dirty trick, is that his attitude is that it's a horror game. It's not necessarily a mythos game. So if he wants to go find himself some supernatural critter, bless you, he wants to find some supernatural critter from mythology that's just awful, he'll go find one and he'll slap it into the story. Bumps of the Night, everything in that book was non-mythos horror. And it was horrible, but it was all from mythologies that were sort of, less well known. We had an Algonquin Indian skeleton that eats the meat off of people and becomes fleshier and fleshier the more people it devours until it's not identifiable as undead anymore. We had some very specific reanimated undead that I would hesitate to call zombies. We had a haunted Incan mummy bundle. Some unpleasant psychics and things like that. He has inflicted varieties of vampires that, don't get a lot of press. Those are always really depressing when you run into the stuff that does not conform to the list of vulnerabilities found on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And suddenly it's a threat that you don't have any idea how to handle because Hollywood, because the movie lied, if I can quote, Return of the Living Dead.
It's always great. I mean, it's always great to mix the two. I put ghosts right next to my mythos threats all the time. I've had a Cthulhu Invictus story where a siren has gotten into an agreement with some deep ones. I've had
and certainly I love the idea that I can take a mythos critter and make it look like a mythological critter, right?
Right.
Like the players are, the players keep hearing about the Chimera, and then it turns out that the Chimera is a Shoggoth, or something like that. That they're, you know, that their expectations are girded by, you know, whatever surface level mythology that the local monkeys have, you know, that have defined what the problem is. And then it turns out to be, you know, the problem behind the curtain, I guess, is what it would be. That can sometimes work. And there is kind of a challenge to saying, you know, how can I slip Serpent Man into a different kind of mythology? You know, thanks to David Icke, we're up to our ass in, you know, Reptoids. So that's real easy. But, you know, I want to, and a number of people, you know, back to Bob Howard, have gone with the little people, you know, have gone with the Serpent Men and their twisted descendants as the fairy, you know, as the thing that has been warped by human experience and bad memory. And
that's one of my favorite. I've got two scenarios with degenerate Serpent Men.
Yeah. So you know, those options also exist of trying to put a cloak of you know, other mythology over the top of a mythos being, you know. And sometimes that can be, you know, really handy. Cody Goodfellow is a writer who wrote a couple of books, Ravenous Dawn and Radiant Dusk, or Radiant Dawn and Ravenous Dusk, I think it is, where he does some really interesting things with Shoggoths. Really interesting things with Shoggoths. Including, you know, things that, you know, would seem, things that would seem, you know, in retrospect, really easy. But, you know, when somebody looks at the stat blocks of the game, maybe it doesn't immediately, you know, they don't immediately get it. If a Shoggoth can form itself into any shape or, you know, extrude any kind of, you know, grow mouths, grow arms, grow limbs, why can't it grow some wings? You know, there's no stats as, you know, what's the flying speed of a Shoggoth? But why, you know, why wouldn't you have an airborne critter if it can be anything it wants?
An African Shoggoth or a European Shoggoth?
I'm gonna say that the African, they're just larger, you know? But they don't migrate. There, I've proved my nerd cred by quoting Python. But
I really think was
it ever in doubt?
Yeah. But you know, something like, you know, that jumps up is there are certain things in the book that just don't, you know, immediately seem obvious. He also did an amazing story. Cody Goodfellow also wrote a short story for a collection. I think it's in Cthulhu 2, which involved an elder thing as the problem. And what was the interesting extrapolation that he made was, since the elder things once upon a time had technology for bossing around Shoggoths, right? And since all terrestrial life is descended from waste products or, you know, byproducts or leftovers of creating these organic bulldozers, you know, this organic construction equipment, I guess you'd call it. They also have the technology to boss us around. It's part of their arsenal of gear, which he had, because obviously if you're going to be a culture that grows a bulldozer that you can boss around as opposed to build one out of inanimate parts, your technology is going to end up built into you. And so he did this interesting thing where, you know, an elder thing is, I guess, mined, pulled out of the bottom of a mine in Peru or something, and immediately sets to work fixing this monkey infestation, you know, that's going on. It was really well done. It was a very, very good story. And the use of an elder thing as a problem, as the problem maker, was really interesting. And you don't usually, you're saying about, if there's a creature that's been underused, well, there's one. Elder things just never get any love. because I don't think people see them as hostile enough. you know what I mean? When I don't see why they wouldn't be. It's their planet. They made us. We're their property. They got a better claim on us than any other species in the book. I don't think they're going to treat us as equals. You know?
Tune in to Dahara Cosmico. I think you might be pleasantly surprised.
Good. Good.
And, you know those things got 7 points of armor, for fuck's sake?
yeah. They're not exactly pushovers. Worse if they actually have some tools. Then it gets really bad.
We're some Pictish allies. It's going to be a hoot.
Perfect. But anyways,
but again, the underrated underused creatures really deserve some love. And there's 100 stories that haven't been told yet, just with the things that never get used in the book because they're not so, you know, maybe the illustration wasn't so good. And you
well, that's the classic complaint about World Sathagwa, is that he got a bad illo. And then everyone forgot about it. Despite the fact there's tons of written material from, you know, Clark Ashton Smith and other writers about Sathagwa.
I go through the book and I find stuff that I've never read in a scenario. And I try and find a way to write a scenario around that just because it hasn't been used. Because I know my players aren't going to know dick about it. Because yeah. I barely know anything about it because no one's ever written anything about it. That's the challenge. That's what we, you know, as authors and industry should be looking for, you know, the new ground. You know, like those people on those gold mining shows, you know, let's find ground that hasn't been mined. It's out there. There's gold to be found. You know, there's lots of great stories that just haven't been told yet. I really believe that.
Yeah, and still using the same toolbox.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Nothing that's not in the book that hasn't been there for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. There's
still plenty of mileage in it. You know, you don't need to make up a new monster all the time. There's plenty of stuff in there that deserves some love. There's plenty of really good spells that nobody ever uses because, you know, they're a little bit difficult and they're a little bit challenging to find a reason to use them. But you could do an entire scenario based on a few of the underutilized spells in the rule book right now. I mean, there's good stuff there.
I was going to say that, you know, you pull open, you know, your Malleus Monstrorum, there's so much stuff in there that has never appeared in any published scenario save for this book, save for, the actual, Malleus Monstrorum. And you know, there's no end of goodies in there. I just don't know, you know, the idea that you're going to run out of stuff because what, you didn't manage to come up with a use for the Tomb Herd from Ramsey Campbell, you know, or, you know, some things obviously get, you know, overused.
Like Illagor and Deep Ones. And
yeah. But at the same time, you know, the Vormese almost never get picked up. The last time I saw the Vormese turn up in a scenario, it was the mummified remains in a pre-human temple, which was great. I was really thrilled with the idea that, oh, it's a primate that appears to be a divergent form of evolution. Yeah, just keep telling yourself that, kids. You know, but but at the same time, you know,
I've got him in the Ravenor saga. Somebody had to bring back the pelt of a wild man. Good luck with that one. One of those creatures that no one's ever used this. I'm going to put it in. That joyful moment. Like, I found one that needs some love.
And there's all kinds of critters that I'd love to find the time. I mean, there's the I would love to find something, and I'm sure I can. with the yugs, the creepy deep sea worms. You know, that's just calling out for something. You know, something involving a bathysphere.
so that's on your list of must eventually use.
I would love to. I was thinking of Sumamus, which is the mouthless vampire-like entity that is. I'm trying to remember which story it's from. What I'll do is I'll just crack open this lovely copy of Malleus Monstrarum and go to page 229, and it's from Brian Lumley's What Dark God. It comes off as kind of a sort of like a vampire. It has vampire-like qualities. And it would be a great thing where you could set the players up with, oh, we're on a vampire hunt. You know, we're dealing with a vampire problem. Yeah. And no, it's actually the problem is a great old one. And that's one of the things that also I think is very underused is we don't get as many great old ones because nobody wants to squash their players like bugs.
There's a dozen great old ones that well-armed investigators have a shot at.
Yes.
I mean, they're not all indestructible death machines. They're not all, you know, rocks fall, players die. There's a good dozen of them that prepared players have a shot. And I've used about six of them.
Yugolnag is one of the classics. You can shoot Yugolnag, the crap out of
Golgoroth. Bugshore. There's a bunch of them, and I'm trying to make a scenario with all of them because whenever you can throw a great old one at a group of players, it's just that's a great afternoon of play.
Yeah,
they're going to be telling that story. Remember when I died? It's usually I'll start. Remember that time we met the great old one and we all died.
Well, who can forget that? Anytime you can get a great old one into the scenario, something that you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily
Kmart, 10x10 room. No.
Oh my God. Yes. Well, what I'm looking for is something where the players have an option for defeating it without necessarily having to go toe-to-toe with it. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of Call of Cthulhu is, aha, we smarted you to death with our smarty pants, you know? And that's kind of what I want to see happen with my players when they're, you know, you give them the opportunities to figure out that, it's a god. It's not a critter.
To me, a perfect scenario is one where the players can go from investigation to resolution without ever entering a round of combat and have an equal chance of having a TPK. That you can get through without firing a shot and you can all die.
Yeah.
Depending on what you do, you can all be dead or you can get to the end without ever firing a shot, throwing a punch, and good luck with that. Out of all the scenarios, I've got maybe three or four that can be true for.
Yeah.
But that's what we should all be trying to do, unless you really want that cinematic combat or that interpersonal drama where there's very little chance for conflict, you know, for physical conflict. But, you know, that perfect game where you can solve it any number of ways.
Combat, we've always treated combat around pagan houses is something to be avoided because dice are not your friends. The dice are uncaring, Lovecraftian universe, and they can go against you. It doesn't matter if you have a rifle of 70 or whatever. It can go very badly. So combat is something that we've always made us nervous because even the dumbest, you know, lamest cultist can roll an 01. And whoops, there goes a player character. The last time we got into a real shootout with cultists was something where, you know, where we couldn't call on the cops to come do it for us. It was something where we knew where they were. We staked out their cabin in the woods. When one of them got up, to go outside and use the crapper, we ambushed them, you know, and killed them on the crapper because there's no fair. There's no fair in murdering cults. There's just no fair. All right? There's no Marcus of Queensbury.
If you're fighting a fair fight, yeah, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, as far as that, the need for combat in the game, we always had it hanging out there. It could happen, but, you know, even our most, our shootiest players, but then I forget about Blair Reynolds, who will initiate a firefight, you know, at the drop of a hat in a scenario. There's a number of scenarios that have gone pear-shaped because Blair had it, the whole game had gone by and he hadn't rolled once to hit. So that's been known to happen. But what else? Do we have anything else to say about this topic, or are we just boring our listeners now?
I think we've got it pretty well covered for now. I'm sure if you're listening out there and you have more questions, feel free to post a comment on the website, and we'll be sure to respond in the next episode.
Demand to know why we didn't bring up X, Y, and Z.
Exactly. This has been episode 20 of Unspeakable. Our guest has been Oscar Rios. Be sure to check out Islands of Ignorance and their other fine works at Golden Goblin Press. This is Ross Payton here with Adam Scott Glancy, and Unspeakable is produced by me, Ross Payton. And this episode's music is Nyarlathotep by The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets, courtesy Divine Industries, copyright 2015. Visit www.thickets.net. See you next time. Neanderthal tale, step into the hell before you head down. Neanderthal tale.